today, talking from Skibbereen in Southern Ireland. It's a great pleasure to listen to one of Britain's greatest ever film producers about his films, and we're going to finish off talking about the state of the film industry today, and would this be a good career for young people to go into? Answer yes, but how exactly will be perhaps the answer there. We'll see. But David Putnam has also been a very distinguished member of the House of Lords, a very distinguished campaigner, environmentalist, educationalist, and generally humane, sane, great and good figure. So, David, welcome. And how exactly did you come into film? I mean, why didn't you do a decent thing like become an accountant or a solicitor?
It's a very good question. I left school very early, Anthony. As I think you know, I was a hopeless scholar, and I fled school at 16. But quite quickly realised that maybe it was a silly thing to have done. And I went to night school. I did 9 courses at a variety of night schools, actually. I went to St Martin's for some art stuff. I went to College of Distributive Trades. I went to London College of Printing, as it was then. And that was my university. And what was wonderful is once I'd left school and was choosing my own curriculum, creating my own curriculum, I discovered to my amazement, and probably my teacher's amazement, that I was a learner. Having literally, you know, when I say written off, I was really written off at school. And the other benefit I had, I lived out at the very end of the Piccadilly line. My first job was at the other end of the Piccadilly line. So I had ample amount of time. I could get a seat and read. And I read and I read and I read and I read. And I think by the age of 21, I was not badly self-educated. But it was a tough time. Like during that time, I got married. Our daughter was born. It was a difficult time. But I emerged from the cocoon of ignorance. That's a nice phrase.
So, I mean, this is Wellington. This is going out round our family of schools. And, that's not a great thumbs up for schooling there, David. What did schools fail you or did somehow they – well, what happened?
Well, I think a number of things. I mean, I'm not daft, and I guess I knew I wasn't daft, but yes, the school failed me in various ways. I would take a thing like maths, which during my career has been a very, very important subject for me. I've done a lot of maths, but when I think about it, at 11, I wasn't bad at arithmetic, right? And then moved on quite quickly to geometry.
Yeah.
I was just beginning to get a grasp of geometry, and someone throws trigonometry at me, an algebra at me. And I was never, ever given a time to actually get my head around any one of those things or become good at them. The truth is, maths itself, arithmetic, let's say, has been fundamental to my life. I can't say I've ever used trigonometry. I haven't used much algebra. I'm very confused if I did, or geography, or geometry. So I think that the way the curriculum we're talking about the mid-1950s. The way the curriculum was constructed was on an assumption. So I was a grammar school boy. The assumption was 3 or 4 or 5 of you might get to university. The rest of you, as you quite rightly say, are going to have very ordinary jobs. Therefore, we'll take you at a fast pace through these subjects. And the ones that can keep up, maybe will get state scholarships. The ones that aren't, well, God bless you. And obviously, most of us left at 16. I mean, after the O-levels, I got 3 O-levels and left.
So what happened then in the 20 years between you being 21 and you producing Local Hero that had Burt Lancaster in it, Peter Capaldi, and directed by Bill Forsyth? We're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about 6 or 7 of your greatest films, but can you just tell us about that journey? And thinking all the time, David, about young people and the journeys. I mean, I know a lot of young people who are desperate to get into film. And were you lucky, or were there things that you did? What are the tips you've got?
Well, unquestionably, I was lucky, but I was also very, I think, quite determined. And I had a kind of vision, I think. My first job, I was a messenger, initially in a publishing house. Then I quite quickly a move to an advertising agency. And it was a kind of round peg in a round hole. I was quickly, within 6 months, promoted out of the messenger department and put on what was those days called a sort of a course where you touch different subject areas within the agency. And I must have been good, I guess. I mean, certainly I was willing. Certainly they knew I was running out of the office at 5:30 at night to go to night school. I was at one point four nights a week in night school, mostly three, in fairness. So I was eager. Maybe it showed, the fact I was eager showed. I was promoted during a holiday when someone was actually, they were short-staffed. I was promoted. And I did enough of a good job that I held that job. And I quite quickly accelerated, to be honest. By 21, I'd been picked up by a very, very good advertising agency called Collett, Dickinson, Pierce, and I became an account executive. And again, luck cut in. I was given a relatively small account, which happened to grow, the actual sector it was in, which was textiles, grew like topsy. And at 22, I was controlling £1 million worth of advertising. A couple of very important things happened there. Number one, I ceased to have any fear of money. I knew that my salary and the money I was responsible for were very, very different things. Therefore, numbers, I was dealing in large numbers at 22. That was one. Secondly, I was trusted, enormously trusted, to get on with things. And the third, most important, was I was sent off to the United States. So I went to the US actually in August 64. And that was an extraordinary experience. I discovered a kind of another world. And I also discovered that my ambition, I'll use that word, my ambition very neatly coincided with an ambition I encountered in New York, which was a different kind of ambition, Anthony, than the ambition I encountered in London. London was still very much a, well, you've done well, young man, but know your place. And what New York did for me was allow me to understand that the possibilities in life were endless, absolutely endless. And anyway, I had a very good career in advertising. At 26, 27, I thought, well, I've done that. What else am I interested in? And there were only two areas. One was music and one was film. Music was doing very well and there's some very, very smart people in it. But the more I looked at the film industry, it was very fuddy-duddy, rather old-fashioned. And I thought, you know what, this is an industry that could do with someone like me. I mean, I'm sounding terrible, but I think you know what I mean. I saw the gap. I really saw there was a gap. I had a partner who was had been an agent, and he, in a sense, he brought an address book with him, and we set up a business. And the rest is history.
And then in 1971, you worked on Melody with Alan Parker, the great director of films like Mississippi Burning and unless I got that wrong, and many, many others. Was he important? I mean, who were the important figures coming through the 1970s that led you towards producing Local Hero, which, by the way, had music by Mark Knopfler of Dire Straits, and and this extraordinary career? What happened in the 70s? Who were your guiding lights and mentors?
I have to jump back to the advertising agency I mentioned. The man who, the creative director of that, was a man called Colin Millwood, who actually was responsible for all of our careers. He hired me, he hired Parker, he hired Charles Saatchi, he hired Ridley Scott. We all worked at one point, a time or another, cheek by jowl, at the same agency. So when I decided to cut loose and go to the film industry, we all had a not dissimilar ambition, in fairness. But I didn't know any writers at all. The only writers I knew wrote ads. And so I asked Saatchi and Alan to both write screenplays. Alan's were very largely based on How I'd Met My Wife, Patsy. I'd made a deal with a young and up-and-coming group called the Bee Gees, and I got some very good music out of them. And we put a movie together, more by luck than by judgment, I suspect. The film was not particularly successful in the UK or the US, got some decent reviews, but was a phenomenon. You ready for this? A phenomenon in Japan. To this day, I had no idea why, but the money it made in Japan allowed me to make my second film, which was terrible. But I survived that because I was already well into my third film, which was That'll Be the Day, which was very successful. So it was a bumpy ride, and more complicated than I'm probably expressing here. But By 1973-4, I was an established film producer, with Alan having given Alan a chance as well by producing Bugsy Malone.
and a lot of music. I mean, the Bee Gees, how did that come about? And then you produced Stardust in 1974, which I think was about David Essex, which I certainly remember as a wonderful film that everyone should see. So just tell us about that. And was this your kind of music, David?
Two things that were, I think, very important here. Because I come out of advertising, I had no preconceived ideas of how you put a film together. There was very little money in film, in the British film industry at that point. You will remember possibly, Anthony, that one very successful sector were these pre-recorded hits records, you know, where you got 20 hits on the same, old hits on the same album. And they were promoted on television. Do you remember?
Yeah. So
I went along, there were two of them, but it was KTEL and Ronco were the two companies. So I went along to Ronco and said, look, would you like to invest in a film? They said, no, we don't invest in films. I said, okay, if I made a film that had 20 odd tracks in it or more, would you promote the album? Oh, yes, we'd love that. That'd be great. It'll give us a, but they came back to me and said, well, it actually would have to be 40 tracks, not 20. So I got 250,000, this is very important, £250,000 worth of commitment from them to promote a film that was going to be made for 150. Now, when I went along to EMI, who didn't much like the script of That'll Be the Day, it says, this is the package I put together. They nearly bit my hand off because no one spent that kind of money on promoting a film. The biggest challenge was getting 40 tracks into a movie. We did that by locating lots of the scenes, you may remember, in fairgrounds. Because every time you walk past a fairground attraction, a different song came out. And so we had these quite long tracking shots of David Essex walking around fairgrounds with different songs. And we were then able to package all of those onto the album. And that was the basis of the extraordinary success of That'll Be the Day. Not so much was it a good movie, but it had more money spent on it in TV advertising than any film before it.
It was extraordinary. And did it do anything to inspire Mark Knopfler in Tunnel of Love? Or, how did you come across him?
That's interesting.
And the sense of fairground?
Well, you'll remember that his second album, Making Movies, I think it was called, actually started with the Carousel Waltz. You remember? Da, 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 da. So I knew that Mark must have an interest in movies, and I wrote to him. And I got back a note and said, that's very interesting. I've never done a film. And actually, I've got some wonderful video of him working on Local Hero, which is the first movie he'd ever done. And he wrote this quite wonderful score. It was so good, I then immediately commissioned him to do another one for a film called Cow, which in some sense is an even better score. He's a lovely man, but he's remained a very good friend.
And so many things we could talk about.
Sorry.
Okay. Who is your favourite? Who would you have on your desert island if you were to have take three tracks from the 70s and 80s?
Oh, I think, because Mark always closes his concerts with the theme from Local Hero, I think that would stay with me. I need something from Elvis Presley because my life changed completely. When we talked about ambition, I was literally listening to Two Way Family Favourites when Heartbreak Hotel came on. Yeah. And you asked about an accountant. I was doing my homework. I put my pen down. I promise it's true. And this is also, I've discovered it's true of other people. I put my pen down. I thought, sod it. There is a whole other world out there that has got nothing to do with the expectations that my school has of me. That was a really important moment. And I've read the same thing about Bruce Springsteen. I've read the same thing about Martin Scorsese, that there is a moment, and often the moment is music, where you think, hang on a second. I want to live a different life from my parents.
You certainly were. In 1977, you produced The Duelist, which was Ridley Scott's first film. How did that come about? And Ridley Scott also coming out of advertising?
Yeah, we knew each other very well. We'd been working on a couple of scripts. Actually, the one we were working on most was a script called The Gunpowder Plot. About the Gunpowder Plot. So what happened was I managed to get Alan Parker's Bugsy Malone made. We got it to Cannes, more by which is sort of a miracle, really. And it was a huge success. And I was standing there with the head of Paramount Pictures, watching Alan being almost carried out of the cinema. And he turned to me and said, oh, that Parker, he's very talented. Do you know anyone else like him? I said, matter of fact, I do. I know a man called Ridley Scott, who's everybody's talented. I wish I'd like to meet him. I ran around the corner. It sounds like a fancy, it really does. Do you remember the days where you put coins in a slot and they were actually jitan? And I'm running around the corner, got on the phone, got Ridley at home. I said, get your ass down to Cannes. We've got a meeting tomorrow with the head of Paramount. And he did, bless him. And we sat on the beach having lunch and we pitched Gunpowder Plot. He asked how much it was going to be. And I said, well, about $2.8 million. And he said, oh, that's too much for a first film. He said, is there anything else? And we'd had a sketchy idea of this Conrad novel, The Duel. So I pitched that. And then he said, well, how much will that cost? And this is a Napoleonic War film, bear in mind. Well, I knew it couldn't be 2.8. So I said, oh, we can make that for 1.4, 1.5. He said, we'll do that one. And there was no script. He didn't read a script. I mean, these are the days of trust, isn't it? And he said, look, if you tell me this guy's good, for 1.5 million, we'll take a gamble. And that's how The Duel got made.
And then Midnight Express, extraordinarily powerful film, 1978, directed by Alan Parker, produced by you, and with a script by the young Oliver Stone.
Yes. The script had been commissioned by Columbia Pictures. And although we only read the book, we committed to doing it on the basis of the book. Alan and Oliver did not get on. And my job really for a long time was to say to Alan, don't worry, the script will get turned in, then you can rewrite it.
Why did they not get on?
Who knows? I mean, it was like just a bad marriage. They never got on. But when the script came in, it was actually superb. There was nothing, didn't need rewriting, didn't need anything else. And we went off to Malta and shot it really pretty well what Oliver had written.
I mean, it was gruesome. Can you just reprise for those who haven't yet seen it? What were you trying? What was the story you were trying to convey?
Well, I don't remember. A young boy called Timothy Davy had a similar experience. A young English boy had been locked up in a Turkish prison with his mother. So it was in the air, if you like. So it was a film about an American who had gone to Turkey, bought some hashish, was trying to smuggle it out of the country, and was caught at the airport. That was what we bought. Now, we discovered, having made the film, that actually was the third time he'd done it. So we were dealing with a slightly less
admirable
figure than we believed we were dealing with. And it was about really whether the crime, the sentence justified the crime justified the sentence, yeah. Because he was sentenced to 30 years. The reason he was sentenced to 30 years was that Nixon and the Turks had fallen out, and the Turks were trying to make a point.
It was quite horrific. Did it disturb you at all, the impact it had on people?
Yes, it did, in two ways. Number one, it really wasn't why I felt I'd come into the film industry, but I think more important than that, at the premiere in New York, which was in Times Square, we'd done this scene, very deliberate scene, where Billy Hayes bites out the tongue of this awful character called Rifkey. And we assumed, and you find him in a mental asylum. So we assumed that the audience would kind of dive under their seats, go, oh, God, how horrible, and that would be that. And when this happened, the audience stood up and started cheering. And I realised that I knew nothing about human emotions, absolutely nothing. But what had happened was we'd made the character whose tongue was bitten so awful that the audience saw it as legitimate revenge. So that was a huge kind of learning curve for me, which was you've got to be very, very careful about what you do in a film. And I've been passing this on to my film students ever since, which is, you are fiddling around inside people's heads. You better know what you're doing, because film is quite a dangerous medium. If you get it wrong, it can be it can cause a lot of damage.
A much softer subject was, I'm missing out, Foxes in 1980, going through to Chariots of Fire. 1981, which everybody has either heard of and most people have seen often several times. What I don't know, can you share with us, is the derivation of that script. And how did that come to you and the setting, the extraordinarily powerful story?
Most of my really successful films have started in some form of either a newspaper article or something. only twice ever as a book, interestingly, literally twice.
And what were those two books, just for record?
Cal. Yeah. And Duel, the Conrad short story, Duel. Okay. The Duel. So what happened was I was in LA and in a sense responding to or reacting to my disquiet on Midnight Express, over Midnight Express. And I was actually at home, not very well. And I was reading a record book. I've always been obsessed by the Olympics. That's a whole thing, goes back to my father having taken me to the 1948 Olympics because he was in charge of all the photography there. And I just happened to come across a paragraph, a tiny paragraph, that talked about this man, Eric Liddell, that no one had ever heard of, having decided not to run on Sunday because of his religious beliefs, because the heats had been run, but eventually winning the 400 metres in a new world record. I thought it was such an extraordinary story that I wrote to the Amateur Athletic Association. They sent me all, I mean, they'd never do it nowadays, all their scrapbooks. It was quite amazing. And I had scrapbooks from 1922, 23, 24, where Liddell turned up time and time again. I sent those in turn to Colin Welland, who I knew a little as a writer. He'd written Yanks, a movie called Yanks. Yes. And Colin fell in love with the story similarly, and Colin wrote the screenplay.
And Liddell, I mean, Liddell's interesting to Wellington because the first overseas school we set up was in Tianjin, which is where he went as a missionary. What was it about his life? And did you admire him for his principal stand on the Sabbath, not running on the Sabbath? And how did all the other characters film? How did you get the through storyline? How did that work out?
Because once we started working on the Liddell story, it became evident that there wasn't enough there to go on. And so reading into it, I came across Abrams and that year man called Douglas Lowe also won the 800 metres, who actually refused to be in the film. That's another whole story. He was a judge and he thought it was all a bit vulgar. So anyway, we focused really on the point counterpoint of a very, very ambitious Abrams and what he went through at Caius College. And this extraordinary man, Liddell. And it was really a question of contrast and running, keeping those stories running side by side. And we created one or two other things. And then we had a huge piece of luck. Colin had put an ad in the Times personal column, and we got a box of letters from a man called Aubrey Montague to his parents. And they formed a really important spine for the film because he wrote to his parents every day about what was happening at the training camp, what it was like at the Olympics. And those became, they were a very, very rich source. I'm not sure the film would have had the character it had without those letters. I'm still massively indebted to the family, which sadly, we actually lost the letters, which is terrible. But
It was extraordinary for, whose idea was it to choose the beach at St. Andrews?
The actual event was at Bournemouth, and rather stupidly, I don't even notice, the film starts, it says Bournemouth, 1922. Wait, it's very evidently at St. Andrews. No, St. Andrews worked for us because so much of the rest of the film was going to be shot up in Scotland. And so you try to cluster locations as close as you can. And so the St. Andrews beach worked perfectly for us.
And the Vangelis music, whose choice was that?
I tried to get him for Midnight Express and couldn't. His record company were very difficult. Hugh Hudson had worked with him on a couple of TV commercials and knew him well. And we made the decision that because we had that Gilbert and Sullivan kind of sound into the film, we wanted to counterpoint that. We were very worried that it would feel like a kind of 1924 revisited movie. We wanted to give it as many contemporary echoes as we could. And the way we knew you could do that, actually, was by using contemporary music. So the idea was, yes, this film set in 1924, but the values it's talking about, the conflicts it's talking about, remember the two, the Gilgud and scenes, they were intended to have a contemporary ring. And I think they do, actually.
The characters were extraordinary. You had Lindsay Anderson and Gilgud together. Vangelis, did you give him a free rein on that choice of music? Did you point him in any way?
Yes and no. We had an album he'd written for a documentary series called Opera Sauvage about animals. And we used that as the sort of our own soundtrack to cut to. Vangelis at the same time was writing the music. And she was kind of unhappy. His father had died. His father had been, I think, a hammer thrower, an Olympic hammer thrower in Greece. And he kept on about, I can do better, I can do better. And I kept saying, look, I'm Bangladesh, there's not much time. We're losing time. We're going to finish the film. Eventually, we finished the movie. And this is an extraordinary story. And my wife and I were having a meal in a restaurant. And Bangladesh turned up with a little cassette and asked us to go into his car and hear the cassette. He got in the car and played it, and boom, 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 the music you're only too familiar with. The hair on the back of your neck stands up. And he said, what do you think? What do you think? I said, it's wonderful, wonderful. I said, it's too late. I've been telling you for ages. The film's finished. Bangladesh, it's too, oh my God, oh my God. So I said, I'll tell you what, we're still working on the front and end titles, which are the very last things you do in a movie because you've got to get the names right. I said, we're doing the titles. Why don't we try it over the titles and see if it works? Well, would you? We did. It did. And what's amazing about the film is that that music that you're so familiar with is never in the movie. It's only over the front and end titles. That's the only time it appears. It occurs. And no one noticed, other than we were very aware of it. But yeah, that's the only time the music's there.
And that's extraordinary. It hadn't occurred to me before. Probably won't to those people listening to this. It just somehow seemed to capture in a way that it's hard to think of many films where the music so captures the spirit of the story. And I mean, it was an extraordinary film for many reasons, including the actors Nigel Havers, Cheryl Campbell, Ian Charleston and Ben Cross. Ian Charleston, of course, went on tragically to die, didn't he, afterwards? Was he an extraordinary... He seemed to capture the little... the character so well. Any thoughts about him?
Yeah, he was an absolutely delightful man. He actually read the Bible in preparation. Sounds great. He actually read the Bible, and the bits he quotes, he chose, which is wonderful. And there's a fantastic moment where Aubrey falls, I don't even remember, in the water jump and it intercuts with Ian in church preaching that morning, and he says, "And he shall rise up as eagles." And it always makes my hair stand on end. There's something fantastic about the juxtaposition of what Ian's saying and that shot. He shall rise up. It's because you see Aubrey crawling out of the water jump and running and coming in fifth. And for me, Aubrey was always every man in the film. We, you know, we don't win for the most part. We do come fifth, but we are. Aubrey's lovely. And actually, at one point, Ben Cross, which is Harold Abrams, says that to him. Aubrey, you're my most perfect man. You're decent. You're balanced. You're not driven like me. And I think that was a very important thing. That was, in a sense, I think that was Colin Welland and I talking to ourselves, saying, you know, that we were both rather driven men, whereas Aubrey was a proper man, a civilized man.
If you were to take just one film to a desert island, would it be Chariots of Fire?
Gosh. No, it would be Local Hero.
In a moment. The wonderful scenes with Ian Holm with his stopwatch. So many extraordinarily powerful, memorable moments from it. And then the race around the college with the bell chiming, which Wellington echoes with its own race on Waterloo Day. Which came first, but whose idea to include that was it?
Oh, that was in the film because that had been done not by Abrams, but by another contemporary of Abrams. So yeah, we were looking for colour. The sad thing there, we weren't allowed to shoot at Trinity, despite all the help I got from Rand Butler at the time. The various masters of the various colleges did not want the film. And we were forced to shoot only on street. So we ended up in Eton. Hugh Hudson was Norwoodtonian, and Eton's got a wonderful reputation for always helping out old Etonians in distress. And we were in distress. We had nowhere to shoot the scene.
And So, I mean, this was just such a rich and extraordinary time in your life with Local Hero in 83 and Killing Fields in 84. So let's just take those. And why was Local Hero so special to you, David?
Well, partly because where I'm speaking to you from here in Ireland is directly relates to my experience of making Local Hero. I was a Londoner. I'd never spent a significant period of time, 12 weeks, in a community. And I discovered that actually this Scotch community where we worked, which was up in Malig, was a wonderful experience. And I came back and I said to Patsy, look, you know, we're missing a beat in our lives. And we started looking for somewhere, and long, boring story, but we ended up literally here at this very, very corner of West Cork, which in an amazing way is very, very similar to the location of Local Hero. So it had a huge impact on my life. And it's one of the best decisions I ever made. We ended up living here full time.
Tell us, just recount the story of Local Hero and your key producing decisions on it.
Basically, I'd read a little article in The Observer about an accountant, I think in Hebrides from memory, who had sued a local oil company for spillage. And it had become quite a drama. He actually then eventually got promoted. But I thought it was a lovely story. And I went to Bill Forsyth, who I knew from National Film Television School. And I'd helped him on his very first film. And we went off and commissioned two journalists, one on the East Coast, one on the West Coast of Scotland, to look for similar tales, similar stories. And Bill then constructed the Local Hero story out of all these newspaper articles of what was going on in the conflict. And at the time, most, he caused me an enormous problem by deciding early on that he wanted Burt Lancaster. And try as I might, I couldn't get Burt Lancaster's agent to budge their price, the price being half the entire budget of the movie. But I learned a really important lesson.
Because which was?
The day we finished the film, we took it to America and we sold it to ABC Television, just the US, just the television rights, not for exactly the amount of money we paid Burt Lancaster. So in one sense, he came free. And I got a different sense of what value for money was.
And in terms of your relationship, just explain the job of a producer compared to a director and the relationship with actors.
Well, I very early on realized there were different types of producers. I wasn't interested in being a lawyer producer or a money man producer because I'd learned in the advertising agency that I really enjoyed the creative process. So I realized I didn't want to be a director. I can't remember why, but anyway, I thought I wasn't going to be a very good director. That's the truth. And so how was I going to become? I've used an expression, I'm sorry, it's slightly unfortunate. How could I ensure that my sperm was in every movie? Is that, if you remember me, I wanted some form of patrimony. The only way you do that is by being the originator of the story, so that you create this idea. You then talk to writers and you get a screenplay out of the idea. You then supervise the production of a film with directors who you admire and trust. And that was my way of working. And I was very hands-on. I also, because I loved music and everything to do with music, I took a very, very strong position on the way the films were scored, always, culminating in Morricone and The Mission, I think, probably the best example. There are any number of producers. The problem with young people is they all think they've got to be a writer-director. And, of course, there are actually, as I teach, there are 84 really interesting jobs that go into making a movie. They're all creative. They're all interesting. They're pretty well paid. And they could, each one of them can be a passion. So the idea that the only avenue into film is to be a writer-director is just fatuous. And I think a lot of very good, very talented people don't enter the industry because they think it's a very narrow corridor, whereas in fact, it's quite a wide spectrum of things. Costume designers, production designers, I mean, you could go on casting directors. They're all incredibly valuable, incredibly interesting jobs. Sound design is a world of its own now.
And indeed, and you would therefore, by implication, recommend young people to be looking seriously at careers in film, which is not something that AI is going to be eating away.
I don't think so. I think that in the end, one great thing about AI, thank God, it doesn't as yet have any imagination. And films rely hugely at every stage on imagination. AI might be able to refine things, might be able to make things cheaper. I'm sure it will have a role in the production process, but it's not going to come up with original ideas that grab people by the throat or grab people in the heart. And that won't happen from AI.
Then during this extraordinary time of your life in 1984, you produced one of, certainly, I think, one of the greatest British films produced, Killing Fields. Saw it in America in 1984, and it had it's had such a powerful impact. Can you tell the story, David, about how that film came to you and what it was about? What were you trying to say in The Killing Fields?
I'd had this success with Chariots of Fire. That had allowed me to raise enough money to make Local Hero. And I was on a high, actually, at the Local Hero studio liked it a lot. And I had a lot of freedom. And I'd read an article in Time magazine, literally a single column in Time magazine, about how this journalist had been reunited with his interpreter in Cambodia. And it was just a summation, really. And again, people are so generous. I wrote to the New York Times. I said, I'm fascinated by this story. Could I find out more about it? And they sent me what they call the blacks. They sent me copies of all the articles that Sidney Schoenberg had written before, during, and after the thing. It was an amazingly generous thing to do. So I wrote to Schoenberg and said, listen, I think this is a movie. He wrote back saying, you're absolutely right. You're a little bit too late, because I've just been commissioned to write the whole thing for the New York Times magazine section. Oh, Jesus. Anyway, that started then a series of discussions, negotiations. And, you know, I often slag agents off, and you shouldn't, because great agents can be fantastically helpful. Schoenberg had an agent called Sam Cohen. Sam Cohen convinced Schoenberg that the kind of film he would like to see resulting from all this would be more likely to be made by me than by the Hollywood machine, despite the fact I was a sort of third underbidder. And that's how I got the rights. And then I was working with Bruce Robinson. I knew Bruce and liked Bruce very much as a writer. And Bruce spent 2 years writing that screenplay. So it's a long process. I'm trying to really shorten it down. It started when I was actually shooting Local Chariots of Fire.
And Mississippi Burning, is that you were not, the involvement there, lack of involvement?
No. Now, here's the interesting thing. So after Midnight Express, it was quite a tough film. And Ellen and I are both quite strong characters, and we argued a lot. And I really made a decision, a very painful decision, that if our friendship was going to survive, we probably couldn't work together. I remember actually being in a car, driving to New York to the airport, having told Ellen that, and crying. I just knew that our very, very close relationship would not survive working to another movie together.
I always see Mississippi Burning as the most powerful anti-racist film or work of art imaginable, up there with the greatest novels. On moving on women, who was the actress? You mentioned Helen Mirren, who you did work with, but who you didn't work with as an actress, who you, without thinking about it, David, you'd most like to have worked with?
Oh, God.
Without thinking about it.
I'm a big fan. Well, at the moment, Emma Stone. I think she's amazing, brave actress. Yeah,
Emma Stone. With no hair.
And now with no hair. But she's got balls. I just think she's fascinating. She's working very closely with a very good producer friend of mine, Ed Gainey, and he adores her. So that's all the validation I need.
And Killing Fields, directed by Roland Joffrey, who you mentioned, an extraordinary film for all those who are mesmerized about the Vietnam War and its aftermath. And then on to Defense of the Realm, which, like many of your films, inspired Hollywood films. I mean, we were talking about No Way Out with Gene Hackman. But Local Hero, inspiring all those films about corrupt, polluting companies that Hollywood made so much money from. But Defense of the Realm, with Gabriel Byrne and the young Greta Scacchi and Denham Elliott, was such a powerful film about the corruption of the British state, and that gave way to so many other films, all the way up to and including Slow Horses.
Well, it did. I mean, this goes back to, I taught very early on in the late 80s. I went to Australia for 6 weeks to teach at the Australian Film School. And it was a very powerful experience, a very good experience. And it was there that I understood of the power of the Murdoch press. and I would say the corrupting power of the Murdoch press. So I became a lifelong enemy of Rupert Murdoch. And at any point in my life, I was able to be difficult. I was, and I got very lucky. You might remember, Anthony, I got to chair the bill, the piece of legislation that created Ofcom.
Yep.
And there was a danger at the time that Murdoch was going to be able to buy ITV. And I was able to get through, despite some slight issues with Tony Blair, I was able to get through a compromise which effectively stopped Murdoch from owning ITV. One of the prouder things of my life. And the other wonderful one is, you remember when it closed down the Daily, the News of the World? He gave a speech to his staff. If you listen to the speech, he blames two people, me and Gordon Brown. So that if I could have anything on my gravestone, it would be to say that Rupert Murdoch blamed me for having to close down the News of the
World. Well, that is another achievement in your career. And this extraordinary 12-year burst of creativity from That'll Be the Day and Stardust through to Defence of the Realm, we'll close the story down there. I mean, there's so many other parts that we can, parts of your multifaceted life that we could talk about, but we will close it there. Just reflections towards the end. What accounted for that burst of creativity? And did you then consciously decide that you would then... Well, you did a lot more in film, obviously, in the later 80s and 90s, including some extraordinary work, but that your focus of your life was shifting.
I think I got Emmy in 1988, and it began to really trouble me. Good days and bad days. That certainly wasn't a fact. The other was, I think, actually creatively, and I feel this quite strongly, you get a run. And I think this is true of all creative people. You know, there's very, very great periods of Picasso and less good periods of Picasso. And I'm not comparing myself to Picasso, believe me. But I think I knew I was on a run, and particularly too with music, I could no longer really remember Memphis Belle. I wasn't sure what Memphis Belle should sound like. And I'd never have to ask myself those questions before. So I thought maybe I was kind of losing it slightly. Can I go back 1 second to something which may be useful for Wellingtonians and others? I mentioned this man, Colin Millward, who hired Parker, Scott, Saatchi, myself, others, and many others. I just got that job, and I was thrilled to be at that agency, but I thought I wasn't good enough. I really did. I thought this is, because it's about confidence, really. And I took myself off to see him to try to explain that I was concerned that I was going to let him down. Anyway, I started trying to explain, and he said, shut up. He was from Acorn Thorpe North. He said, shut up. Why do you think you're here, Sonny? I was 21. I said, well, you know, you interviewed me 3 times. You must have seen something in me. And blah, blah, blah. No, he said, not at all. He said, you are here. You are here for one reason, and one reason only. You are here to amaze me. You want to amaze me. You are not amazing me. Go away and start amazing me, and everything will be fine. Thank you very much. That was it. So I went back to my little cubicle. I think I wept, and I must have pulled my finger out. I did something right. I didn't get the sack. That was the point. And I think that moment was really important. I realized that being good wasn't enough. That actually you had to set out and be excellent. That was a gap between good and excellent. And I tried to make myself really, really, I'm being conceited here, I promise you. I tried to make myself excellent at whatever I did. And that meant putting in more effort, more time. Being dissatisfied, which I'm sure you're, being dissatisfied with the first draft, realizing you can improve the second draft. It's a tick, isn't it? It's a tick in you. Then you say, actually, I can do better than this. I can do better than this. And I think that's had a huge impact on my life. And I think come back all the way back, to Nord Anglia. I feel that with Nord Anglia. I know that with Andrew, I'm constantly hearing, Andrew, I know you're pleased, but I think I could do better. I think we could do better. You know, whole issue of continuous professional development, which we spent very, very large sums of money on, is so satisfying. I worked with Steve Mumby on that. So satisfying because we're seeing results. And so I'm kind of trying to hammer home to everyone I can, you can be better at what you do than you know. And if you are, you can be more satisfied. You might be tired. You'll be more satisfied, and you might just make a bit of a change in the world.
Who's the most spiritual person you met in your life?
I met an extraordinary man at the time of Midnight Express afterwards, when I talked about being disquiet. I'm not a Catholic, but he was, like I said, he was the, I'm going to think of his name in a moment. He was the head of Heythrop College, the Catholic.
Yeah,
He was an absolutely wonderful man. And I met him two or three times. And he's the one who said to me, look, you know, I know you're a bit bothered. Do realize that the power of cinema, well used, is greater than, he said, I remember him saying, greater than mine. He said, you know, I'm here. I try and teach religion, everything else. And it was that, I think he, more than anyone, said, was saying to me, look, if you're going to do this, and you're clearly quite good at it, make sure you choose your subjects in terms of what the outcomes for the audience is. So I would argue that Chariots of Fire, Local Hero, certainly The Mission, certainly Killing Fields, were directly related to his insistence, not insistence, his saying to me with such absolute conviction, it's a wonderful medium, use it.
Love it. That's a great way to end this. And David Putnam, thank you so very, very much. What a delightful 40 minutes that was. Thank you.
Very great pleasure. Thank you for having me.